the top of your mind. Put your eyes on the earth. Lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now and you will see we're only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life.
Yes, sirree, we're only here by the skin of our teeth. It gets more and more evident each day, especially as events like these bomb cyclones that are hitting the planet with a greater rapidity and doing incredibly massive damage. Anyway, you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Roland. I have with me my generally second Wednesday co-host, but she was on the road last 2 weeks ago. Now she's now here, Jacqueline Keeler.
Yes, hi. Glad to be here.
Good to have you back. Mm-hmm. And you witnessed this bomb cyclone and its aftermath, and we'll be talking about that. And I, we've got another guest joining us, Terry Crawford Hansen, who's a Ho-Chunk journalist who has covered the issue of climate change in Indian country for 30 years. And she'll be calling in presently. And so we'll be having a full discussion on what just happened and what it means, what it means for our immediate and long-term future when such events hit places like the Missouri and Mississippi River system, whose effects are only beginning, really just beginning, as the water moves downstream. So, Jacqueline, you were, last I heard, you were flying to South Dakota before this whole thing happened. So talk about your experience of it.
Yeah, so I flew back to my dad's reservation in South Dakota, on the Yankton Sioux Reservation, and they're having my dad's cousin Faith Spotted Eagle was puts together every year. This was the 15th annual Water Lily Storytelling Festival, and it's like a 4-day event. It goes all day, and Dakota and Lakota people and Nakota people from all over the Great Plains come, and they share their traditional stories, their oral stories, their experiences, and it's just this amazing, wonderful, very healing experience to go and share these things. And she holds a lot of it at the Braveheart Lodge, which is a very warm place. And so I was really looking forward to it, to kind of get myself free, kind of oriented by that experience. It's a very nourishing experience in a way. And so I thought I had to fly on to Amherst. So I chose to fly into Omaha because there were more flights available to Connecticut. Anyway, so I ended up driving through a lot of this stuff. The roads were flooded, in South Dakota, and I accidentally drove through a giant puddle, it was pretty frightening. And I managed to get there, and then after I checked into the tribal casino, it snowed. It totally, there was a blizzard at 3 a.m. and I woke up and it was completely, all the roads were covered in snow. And then I had to, luckily they plowed them and I was able to drive out in time to catch my plane. But when I got to Omaha, the entire freeway was cut off. Like, I've never seen an entire U.S. freeway, like 8-line, this huge freeway, be completely shut down. So
with a lot of people on it.
It was silent. It was it was eerie. There were semi trucks that had pulled over onto the off ramps just to kind of rest. It was really frightening. And there was like debris on the road. It looked like a disaster movie. you know, there were trees, there was like dirt, you know, you could see that the side roads, the side highways, the state highways were completely unusable. And I just wondered how the people in those communities could get around. And I got to the airport, I had to drive 70 miles into Iowa and back around and approach Omaha from the south to get to the airport, which is in Iowa as well, because it's very, and it was just, I barely got there in time, but I the next day it was worse. Like the flooding became worse. And right now, I think you saw the New York Times article, and I think NPR covered it today with Pine Ridge being underwater. The Santee Sioux tribe in Nebraska, of course, was underwater, and they have filed for $30 million in federal and state recovery. And so that's one. The Santee tribe is a fairly small tribe there in northeastern Nebraska. So.
So obviously this disaster hit a large area, many states and many different cities, towns, rural areas. So it didn't obviously just hit Native communities, but as often happens, Native communities being already so marginalized and isolated tend to both get hit hardest in terms of both their difficulty in responding because of their limited resources, and often they're on the last of the list of getting help. I noticed the South Dakota governor said that she responded when she got word. I don't know if that's true or not, but obviously there's still people many people suffering who've lost their homes, who've lost their farms, and we're only beginning to calculate the damages, but it seems like some of the Native communities are still very, very hard hit, are still not getting the help that they need.
Yeah, I was on Twitter talking to Native folks on the ground there, and one young woman, she's at her mom's yard, is not only a mess, and she posted a photo of it just with snow and water, but she ran out of propane Saturday night. And so she called the tribe, the Rosebud Sioux tribe, to come and fill her tank, but the driver got stuck in her yard. And actually, she posted a photo of the truck stuck there. But they had to get a front loader to dig him out. And so next, her furnace blower went out, so she's without heat. So a lot of, and this isn't the only instance I've heard where Native folks, you know, their homes sometimes need repair, and they're in the midst of all this, and they can't get them repaired, and they're without heat and you know, and other, in the middle, I mean, it's very cold there, so.
Yeah, it's hard to, people have this image of all this rain falling upon one reason it's such an immense disaster is because there was already massive snow had fallen in the past month, and then all this rain on top of it. But I guess there's still, at the same time, there was, as part of this cyclone system was a large snowstorm as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So that meant it created a surface where the water just drained out. It overflowed into the rivers. And also there is threats of more flooding from the Missouri River in the spring. And of course, they still haven't had the spring floods. This isn't even that. And there's been a big snowpack, and they're expecting even more flooding in the month to come. So this isn't over. And you can see the amounts of money that are required. A lot of the, Pine Ridge, a lot of the large trucks the tribe has to deal with these things have been incapacitated by the flood. You know, and of course, like you said, they are last on the list to get the governor Noem. Christy Noem, she was supported by Trump. She's really a far right conservative, and she was not responsive originally to any of their calls. And certainly at the state level, there's a notion that, you know, well, if tribes are sovereign nations, they should do this themselves. Yet so much of the appropriations that Congress does goes through the states, then to the tribes. They don't go directly to the tribes, so that there becomes a real gap in funding.
Well, let's bring Terry Hansen, who is on the phone with us, into this conversation, who, as I said, has been covering the issue of climate change in Indian country for 30 years or more. And good morning, Terry.
Oh, good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Terry.
So, yeah, this is a, you know, it's a one-time event, but obviously not just a one-time event, because these events are happening all together too frequently now, and so they kind of add, they accumulate. But you've also got the longer term, you know, issue of what's happening to the climate that this is represents. Talk about your, you know, your reporting over the years and this particular event in terms of what's happening in Indian country.
I first of all, I don't believe we've met.
No,
sir.
No, we haven't.
So, who am I speaking?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Paul Rowland. I'm the regular host, and Jacqueline is the once a month co-host of this program.
Okay, it's great to be here. I read a story about the disaster that hit the tribes. With the flooding, but I'm not really familiar with it. I've been on Deadline writing a story about climate to the tribes in the Pacific Northwest, and I get really involved when I'm on Deadline, and I kind of put blinders on. Unfortunately, my own tribe was hit by that disaster, the Winnebago tribe of Nebraska. But I have been actually covering the environment for 30 years and climate change for the last 10 years. And it's been having a bad effect, across, you know, a bad impact to tribes across the country. All of the impacts that we're seeing in one way or another, from ocean acidification to increasing drought to the wildfires to at decreasing snowpack, you know, up in Alaska, they actually have seen some of the earliest impacts. We could talk about any of them. They're also some of the earliest created some of the earliest adaptation plans, and they've been like models for other municipalities to model their own plans. So because, you know, they have always, they have had to adapt, in one way or another. They're very resilient. And so they were just very early planners.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the reason why, why it's important to talk about, Indigenous communities and nations and peoples, in terms of climate change, is obviously that's something you focus on and Jacqueline focuses on. But why people more broadly should be concerned is maybe you could talk a little bit about that. Obviously, part of it is both their, I guess their, you know, I guess you'd say exposure in terms of living in more marginal environments. Often, is that one reason?
Well, they're so closely connected to their environment, especially the tribal nations that are still located on their ancestral homelands, you know, in considerably smaller parcels of land, but still on their ancestral homelands, who still practice subsistence ways of living. They're interconnected with their ecosystems. It's who they are. You can't separate them from, you know, and if they're coastal like the Quinault and they're losing their clams, well, that is who they are.
Mm-hmm.
The clams define them, and they are losing their clams to ocean acidification, to hypoxia, and it's so they're seeing some of the earliest impacts, and again, that's been happening up in Alaska prior to even climate change coming out on the national radar. And they also, because of this, they've been able, with what we call traditional knowledges, they've been able to help scientists understand some of those changes because they're on the ground. Yes, it's wrenching what is happening.
Yeah, I think we often... Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I think we often think of climate changes affecting coastal regions for sure, and certainly here in the Pacific Northwest, but also the river. People who are on the rivers are also impacted. And you know, when you look at the bomb cyclone in the Midwest, you know, it's estimated to impact a range of 70 million people. And you know, and I talked to a cousin of mine, Manape, and he's Yankton, but his stepfather is I think Winnebago from Nebraska, and I was asking him about that and about all the flooding, and he's like, well, we never built in the floodplains, you know, traditionally, and a lot of where these communities are, particularly on the Missouri River, these Indian communities, it's been sort of dictated by the Army Corps of Engineers and their engineering projects, and it's the failure of a lot of these dams that have actually exacerbated a lot of the flooding in this region. I think a lot of these areas, like, you know, even these farming communities, we don't realize how, you know, where they're located, it relies on a lot of heavy engineering, you know, and uh-huh. and the funding, the infrastructure funding to maintain those projects or to readapt them. Nobody has their eye on that ball, you know, I feel, in D.C. And although I imagine, you know, the sort of political clout that states, red states like South Dakota and Nebraska have in D.C. is probably will help their white constituents. But I don't think that will be equally shared with the native communities. And so I think it will. I mean, it will definitely impact them to a much greater degree. I see a lot of tweets from Native people saying to President Trump, saying that that this is the real emergency, not the southern border.
Right, I know. Right, you know, it's interesting because of a lot of the scientists within these federal agencies do respect the traditional knowledges. You say that Native peoples didn't build in the floodplain, and these old knowledges are passed down faithfully through the generations, word for word for word, and they understand that, you know, and the scientists respect that the traditional knowledges, they're being used in climate science. So the scientists respect that, but that's not heeded necessarily at the effort levels, like you were speaking about the Trump administration. And then this is what happens. The Army Corps of Engineers goes in and does it all wrong, and then we pay the price later, when, especially as the climate changes, and we're going to see more events like this, more extreme weather events. And we've built our infrastructure all wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I think I actually, you know, the area, particularly for, and I don't have numbers for the Winnebago tribe, but I know that the Santee Sioux tribe in Nebraska, I said this earlier in the show, requested $30 million in federal and state aid to deal with this, with the flooding. And they haven't received any of it yet. But and that's just one tribe. And you know, that's not a big tribe.
Not a lot of money either.
Yeah, and then of course the Santee are living there on the Missouri River in Nebraska, because of course they were driven out of Minnesota, you know. Uh-huh. And they took refuge with my dad's people, with the Yanktons, the Yankton Dakota people, and that's how they ended up across the river from us. And but you know, their homeland is in Minnesota, you know. And uh-huh. but the uh But of course, all over the Ocheti Shoko and the Great Sioux Nation, you know, I have a report here from Cheyenne River, which is very far north from there, from north, sort of north central South Dakota. And, you know, a Jay Cook of Cheyenne River says, very proud of our emergency team for the picture painted in the memory of those we helped. He said, we will be out again today and tomorrow and next till we have our handicapped, our elderly, our sickly taken care of today. We'll be doing snow removal for dialysis patients so they can help themselves each day. The snow blows back in what was removed the day before. And you know, I think in the New York Times there was a description of a 59-year-old woman. Was she in Pine Ridge or which reservation?
I think so.
And she was actually, she had to get to her cancer treatment. And she actually rode a horse in the snow, walked until she finally could get to a location where she could get picked up and taken to the hospital. So access to healthcare is an issue, and you know, just getting, you know, the infrastructure is not good to begin with on the reservations, and there's not been a lot of resources allocated to that. And then I talked to some a friend of mine, Avis Little Eagle. She's the publisher of the Teton Times up on Standing Rock, and and she was saying that you know, her sister's furnace has gone out, or she had an electrical thing, and so she has no heat. And they and I asked her what's the situation financially with the tribe, because of course they took a huge hit after after the camp. The Dakota Access Pipeline protest, and they haven't really recovered financially because they relied heavily on their casino, and that hasn't really gotten back to where it was before. And it funds a lot of these programs, you know, a lot of the infrastructure projects and helping the elderly get heat, and so, you know, where they're going to find the money to deal with this, they don't know.
Yeah, it's the irony, or the bitter irony of that protest that took place there on the Missouri River, and now the Mother Nature is, and the power of water is being shown with a vengeance here. But the, you know, I think there's a deeper question, which is, you know, the within this capitalist system and the accumulation of all these profits from all these pipeline, all these extractive activities, and all those companies that, you know, those are also resources that are being locked up, just like the resources that are being devoted to the absurd Southern Wall and the Pentagon. And, you know, the Pentagon itself is one of the foremost studiers of climate change and has recognized that it's a national security issue. Yet we're still locked into the situation where we're just totally, absolutely unprepared for these massive events that are hitting us, you know, just in terms of being able to respond on a, as you said, on a individual, human, and community level, let alone all the money that's going to be required. I mean, where is the money going to come from in the end if these things keep accumulating?
Well, I think that if you ever travel through South Dakota or Nebraska, you will see a distinct difference between the the infrastructure in white communities versus the infrastructure in Native communities. You know, I think a lot of these South Dakota towns you'll see look very neat and orderly, and they have all the money. Do you know what I mean? And then you go through the Indian communities, and it's not like that, because there is very little funding going towards infrastructure, right? And this is, you know, these were things that we were guaranteed under treaty. Some of the treaties are an active violation. You know, the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868, you know, basically they are supposed to return about everything west of the Missouri River in South Dakota should go back to the Great Sioux Nation. You know, if they returned the Black Hills, you know, where Mount Rushmore is, if they returned everything west of the Missouri River, you know, we might need a lot less federal aid. These treaty these treaty obligations, you know, I mean, this is where the wealth is, and this is why these white towns are so wealthy. You know, I think if you look at South Dakota, it has one of the highest rates of social mobility left in the country, and this is because the white community has absorbed so much of the wealth to themselves. Do you know what I mean? And of course you have counties like Bennett County, where Pine Ridge is, which is consistently ranked as one of the poorest counties in the country, right? In a state that has one of the highest social mobility rates. right, for white people. And so there is this real have and have not situation. I assure you that all those flooded communities in Nebraska will get the money they need to fix themselves, but I'm not so sure about the Santee Sioux tribe. Do you mean?
Well, your point is absolutely well taken. I question to what degree at some point there is going to be able to rebuild even those communities where the climate change is going so fast. It's really remarkable. Maybe Terry, talk about some of your other experiences, you know, in covering Native communities, you know, in light of what Jackie's saying.
Well, actually, you know, you bring up some good points. We need some sort of a fund that can step in and help communities hit by the effects of climate change. That, in my mind, this was not expected. I wouldn't have expected to have to cover these tribes due to an event like this. But events, unexpected events, are going to happen. And we need a funding source. You talked about the Pentagon. They're asking for over $2 billion. And they just said for unfunded needs, they're asking for over $2 billion, yet they just said that they could dedicate $1 billion to build 57 feet of the wall, which doesn't make any sense.
57 and feet. That's not very far, is it?
57 feet.
$1 billion. Wow.
$1 billion, and they just asked for over $2 billion for unfunded needs, and we need a dedicated fund that will step in and take care of unexpected climate events that devastate tribes and counties and that don't have the resources, you know. Because unexpected events. Who could have predicted that this was, in my mind, I wouldn't have expected this. But there are other, yes, expected events. So I have done a lot of reporting in the Pacific Northwest. It's really affecting the salmon runs because of the diminished glacial runoff, you know, diminished snowpack, diminished in the rivers. That's just what in the warming oceans that's affecting the shellfish and the marine life. They're having a lot of impacts in the Pacific Northwest. That's a story I'm working on right now for Yes Magazine. I'm on deadline.
What's the title of the story?
Oh, I don't know what the title is. It's about there's some more science that's being offered to those tribes to develop more planning, but they're really leaders in adaptation planning in the Pacific Northwest, to the point that they were some of the earliest adaptation planners, and their plans could be templates and have been templates for other non-tribal municipalities to follow.
So you're talking about the individual tribes as well as, say, like the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission and the affiliated tribes in Northwest? Who's doing the planning?
Well, so the Swinomish it was 2006 that they first took a look at their tribe. They were surrounded almost completely by water. They somehow heard or realized that there were predictions that, you know, that sea level could rise, and they realized that in 2006. In 2008, they started putting, you know, penciling it out. I believe in 2008, they put it to paper. In 2000, they may have had the plan in 2008. I'd have to go back and look. It was 2008, because that's the first year I did a story. I traveled up there and did a story, not on the Swinomish, but I did a story on the Quinault Quileuton Hole and climate change. And then I came home, and then I found out about the Swinomish, and I was very sorry that I hadn't visited them as well. So that was one of the earliest adaptation plans in the country, was their plan.
Yeah, I think that the bomb cyclone, of course, was caused by the the vast amount of moisture that's been building up in the atmosphere because of greenhouse gas impacts, and this has actually been lead to flooding not only in the Midwest, but also in coastal communities. And there was a government report issued last November by the National Climate Assessment that said that climate change would increase the costs for farming and fisheries and because of these increasing powerful storms.
Right. That was one of the, when I did the story in 2008, the scientists I talked with said that there would be more extreme weather events. You can't necessarily point to an individual storm and say it was caused by the changing climate, but I call it climate breakdown now. I don't call it climate change. What we're seeing is the climate is breaking down. But there are more extreme weather events, and it's contributing to them. And we will see more and more of these.
I just wanted to let people know that this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland. The voice you just heard is Terry Hansen, a native journalist who's been covering the environment and climate change here in the Pacific Northwest. I understand you actually wrote for the Oregonian for quite a while. And also my once-a-month co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who's here on the fourth Wednesday because she was traveling to South Dakota, which she's been talking about 2 weeks ago. I want to let you know that coming up next, The Radioactivist has Lisa Loving and Suzanne LeGrand and guests who are discussing bee corporations and a new beach at Waterfront Park. At 10, Making Contact visits with two key organizers in Europe whose work is advancing women's reproductive rights. After that, at 10:30, Radio Zine welcomes the Portland-based organization The People's Colloquium. And 11, KBOO's James Dixon sits down with the director of the play Jump, Latevin Alexander. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. If you haven't yet done so, to become a member, please go to kbo.fm and click on the button marked Donate. Of course, we're coming up on our membership drive in just a couple weeks. And this is a call-in show. We have, unfortunately, one line is not working, and one line is taken up by our guest, Terry, who may have to go at some point. I understand she's on deadline. So let us know if and when you do have to leave us. The number to call in to join our conversation, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Be patient because, as I said, we only have one line available for that. Yes, these are obviously more and more people are taking seriously climate change. Hopefully it's not too late to both do something to minimize its impact and also, as we're talking about, to adapt. We're specifically talking about indigenous communities adapting and dealing with these massive disturbances caused by these now we may have to expect the unexpected events like a massive late winter storm exacerbated by a massive so-called bomb cyclone dumping unprecedented amounts of rain on top of that snow and causing these flooding events, which are just going to continue for apparently for months. They're talking about, and this we're talking about the, you know, these massive farmlands. This is like the agricultural heartland of the United States, and this is going to have global impacts as well.
Yeah, a lot of the farmers and ranchers are losing their crops because, of course, you know, particularly livestock feed and things that they rely on, and will have to actually purchase. The National Congress of American Indians has, and we have a link to it on our page, to a call to action on how to help tribal nations in the Great Plains hit hard by the bomb cyclone. And they have a list of different tribes who have been impacted. This probably will need to be updated to include tribes in South Dakota, but they have the Meskwaki Nation, the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi and Iowa, the Omaha Tribe in Nebraska, the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska, the Santee Sioux Nation, also in Nebraska, and also they, you know, you can check with the Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Association for more updates. And you know, Terry, I wanted to ask you, you know, what do you think? You know, you said that you feel like tribes here in the Pacific Northwest and in Alaska have been proactive in this matter. What do you think that these tribes, other tribes around the country, could learn from them?
Well, so they do have. They have an annual, I don't know the exact name, it's a stewardship conference, and they do exchange ideas, and quickly the organizations have sprang up teaching adaptation plans to tribes across the country. On the East Coast, they're dealing with ocean acidification. So they are in the Southwest, you know, they're dealing with an ongoing drought. So it didn't take long. The first adaptation planning workshop was held in 2010. The tribes have been more proactive than municipalities. There's a cohesiveness there, you know, tribal peoples have had to be resilient. You know, we've dealt with colonialism and, you know, and survived. I would like to leave you with some thoughts, especially because the climate anxiety that especially our younger people feel, you know, the future is going to be different, but we can still thrive. You were mentioning food and crop losses and things. What this means is that we're going to need to be dependent upon ourselves. We're going to need to start planting our own fruit and nut trees and learning how to grow our own foods. Everybody's going to need to have their own gardens. We need to start planting our own fruit and nut trees now so that they're mature. Backyard sharing, you know, I mean, I know we know these things. We're need to going to put them into practice and become reliant upon ourselves so that when there are crop losses, we will have foods. We're going to have to teach our neighbors how to grow their own foods. Because if we don't, they will want our foods. We're going to need to become cooperative.
Yeah, I think you know, the food sovereignty movement in Indian country has been, you know, really quite notable, and I know that they've had meetings here in Portland about that, and
yes.
So it's yeah, I see that actually the university. The University of Oregon has a tribal climate change project as well.
Yes, they do. They do. And so that's for the Pacific Northwest, and they have a listserv. And, you know, there's a lot that Indian country can teach non-Native peoples. A lot of the work we're doing, like in food sovereignty and the cooperation, and in our book, Jackie, mm-hmm.
Yeah, we should probably mention that, but the book. I should say that Terry and I are, well, Terry has invited me to join her to on co-editing a book about tribal communities and climate change.
Actually, it'll be a co-writing.
Co-writing.
Not just
editing.
Editing would be easy.
True.
But we need to start now. I just want the young people not to be too discouraged. It's going to be hard work, but it can still be a good life.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate all your work on this. I know that you've been at the forefront of reporting on this for decades now, and on the environment and also climate change.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I think I need to get back to the grind.
Yes.
I appreciate KBOO. It's been a while. I haven't been in Portland, but KBOO and I go back a long ways.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Okay, well, thanks for joining us this morning. And that's, again, Terry Hansen. And look for that article coming up in Yes Magazine. I guess a shout-out to Yes, because they featured both Jacqueline's work and others. They've definitely been one of the magazines on the forefront of dealing with sort of these cutting-edge issues, yeah?
Yes, they have. And they try to take a positive, you know, viewpoint, I think. And, Terry and I both write, contribute at Yes Magazine. And she's been invited by the University of Washington Press to write this book on environment and climate change reporting. And she invited me to co-write it with her. So I've been, that'll be coming out from the University of Washington, probably not for another year.
Just what you needed, another project.
Oh, it's fun. I mean, I love writing about that stuff. One of the great things about writing about, you know, the environment and climate change, and because it's like what Terry said, it's so central to our identity as Indigenous people. I go into communities and I get to, you know, I've written, about, you know, salmon runs, and I'm not from a salmon tribe, but I learned so much, you know, from talking to tribal leaders and people about, you know, how they use the land and what it means to them. And it really resonates with me, even though, you know, it's not my culture or traditions, you know, sometimes. And but I, you know, I have this definition of Indigenous people, and I think I've mentioned it on the show before. And I got the definition from my grandma's cousin, Vine Delore Jr. I think he wrote a book called For This Land. And in the book, he describes how he says, you know, our people, we always call ourselves the people. Like, that's usually what our name means. Like Diné, Navajo, that means the people, right? And so he was saying that a people have their origin story in a meeting with a sacred being who is a manifestation of the land itself. And in that meeting, they get instructions. They get, they make an agreement with the spiritual being who's the manifestation of the land, and how they're going to live on the land, what their responsibilities are, what they can and cannot do. And it's because of this relationship that we have different outcomes than a colonial, than a colonist would, right? Because the colonist is all about, you know, coming in. And I call this country is still a colony, basically. This is how it operates. This is its origin story, is as a colony. And I would say the same thing for Canada and even Mexico.
Extracts wealth to a global economy.
Yeah. Extracts wealth, ships it back to the 1%, the ruling class, and that's the whole definition of a colony. And so it's I think that when you're looking at Indigenous people and their relationship to the land, and it's to a specific place on Earth, like, you know, for, of course, my father's people, it's the Great Plains. You know, we met the white buffalo calf woman. She was a manifestation of the Great Plains and of our relationship with the buffalo, the Tatanka Oyate, you know, the buffalo nation. And then, of course, my mother's people, it's the Dinata. It's the area between the four sacred mountains and the four sacred rivers. So there's a specificity to the landscape. So we're not like an international corporation. We can just move all over the world and profit off it and leave the mess behind and go on. You know, this is our homeland. This is what defines us, like Terry said, as a people. And when we lose that relationship to the to these different aspects of the land, whether it's, you know, clams or salmon or the corn Or the buffalo, you know, we lose a part of ourselves, which defines us as a people. And so that's why, you know, we are a people who are in place. We have to deal with these issues, because this is our home, right? We're not going anywhere. And so, yeah.
And of course that's, I mean, despite having a relatively more alienated relationship and less, you know, deep historical ties, still, I mean, events like this, people are, you know, look at Katrina, look at all these hurricanes and mass events, look at what's going on in Africa. This is, for all people who are affected by a flood, it impacts people in a very deep emotional way, because it, you know, it is their, also their, it may be just their individual dwelling, but it's their home. And, or, you know, your people are losing their farms. People have, you know, not just invested money, they've also, you know, invested time and emotion and sweat and blood. So obviously, the more people are able to connect what's happening to them, not just a, you know, an act of nature or God or whatever, that to actual human actions that are part of this historical process, perhaps that can increase our ability to actually, you know, wake ourselves up, well, to address it.
I think the problem is systemic. I mean, the problem is always systemic. It's easy to do what the system, what the system does. Do you know what I mean? Because we have, so little awareness of what systems do. And also we often, it takes a while to figure out how to impact those systems as an individual or even as a group. And, I think NPR just came out with a report maybe a month ago or so about how with these FEMA funds, most of the money goes to wealthier people. You know, it's easier for them to access that money so that they can then rebuild or restart their lives. Often they end up wealthier than they were before, you know. But for poor people who are renters or who can't file those claims in the same way, you know, they become poorer because of it, because they lose all their belongings. They don't get any funds to rebuild. They may even lose their jobs because they can't get to work because their car is destroyed in a flood, you know, and there's no resources to help them, you know. And so the way the system is set up, even the system of recovery, the money tends to flow naturally to those who already have wealth and can access the system. And the way the system is set up, it's set up to help them. And so this is the real danger that I think that climate change or these sorts of the unpredictability of these storms, is that for Native communities, you know, who are already, you know, underfunded, and will the Santee Sioux tribe get that $30 million? I don't know. You know, I hope so, but I'm pretty doubtful. You know, in these really red states where you have a Republican governor and legislature and Congress, Congress and Senate representation, you know, there's very little inclination to address that part of the voter base. You know, I think I've talked when I covered the midterms, you know, the way in which when the Native vote elects a senator, you know, whether you're talking about Senator Heitkamp in North Dakota or Senator Hoeven in Montana, or, even a Republican senator what's her name in Alaska? Murkowski. Yeah. Then those senators become much more responsive to the needs of their Native constituents because they know they owe their seat to them, you know. But in these states, and of course, North Dakota, they lost Heitkamp, and now they have this horrible guy. Is his name Craven? Or he's just this horrible, and this total. They have all these very trollish Trump supporting, folks in charge, and they, you know, the likelihood that they're going to be given any sort of support for what they need to recover may leave them even further down. You may leave their communities even with less infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, Naomi Klein's this discussion of the shock doctrine, that these, you know, we think that these events will, as I said, will wake us up, but unfortunately they, you know, because people are so hard hit and don't get the support they need, that it can be the opposite. And, you know, probably those big, you know, multimillionaire farmers, they're going to be obviously the first in line to to, you know, they may have to get out of the business, but they're going to have a parachute, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's, and they, I think it's, I'm very concerned, and I, I see the community where my dad grew up in South Dakota, and originally it was a white town on the reservation. And it was the county seat. It's still the county seat. So it was doing very well. But the minute it became an Indian majority community, the white people left and they took everything with them all. And so suddenly there's no resources that used to be there. And it's, I think that often they know how they control power, but they don't admit it. And so then it continues this imbalance. And when communities like Standing Rock stand up, they pay the price. And it makes their situation even more marginal.
It seems like we're really coming to a head with everything going on. I mean, I've analyzed this whole Trump presidency as sort of the ultimate retrograde reaction, kind of like the Afrikaners, sort of the hardcore sort of resisting the inevitable movement to end the apartheid system. That's why that's basically what I see Trumpism as the demographic shift, the waning of the white domination is sort of threatening these bastions. And it seems like certainly what's happening with the one thing I want to get out. I haven't really said this on my show. I mean, I just feel, as I've learned, the history of Native people and the history of this country and just the beauty, the immense beauty that America, what's called America, was here and still is in some places. But it's just such a terrible tragedy. And I think it's I think fundamentally it's like the denial, the inability to come to grips with what we have done as Europeans is part of the inability to actually look at
as colonizers
the reality of, yeah, as of colonizers. The reality of climate change, because in order to look at that we have to look at what established it to begin with, and that's like impossible.
Well, that's really what the focus of my book Standoff is that origin story of how things started. And I hope I'm not publishing it. I'm submitting the manuscript finally in May to my publisher, and I hope it doesn't come out in the midst of a second Trump administration. But even if it does, it will go a long way to explaining why Trump is. Do I mean, I think that people were hoping the Mueller report would be some magic bullet to take out this and not this noxious form of, this thing. But I think that what I think most even white liberal Americans need to understand is that this is a fundamental part of America. And that this is the problem. I mean, if we lose the world to climate change because white Republicans are voting for white supremacy, it shows that white supremacy, which was invented in America, in Virginia, with racism for slavery, if that brings about the end of the world, what does that mean? Do you know what I mean? And I, I actually was invited to speak at the College of William and Mary last year, and I told this to the students there, and they're all from Virginia mostly, and they were completely shocked because they had never thought of the legacy of their state being like that, or their history of their state. And but I'd like to leave this in a positive note. I think, like Terry said, we want our young people to believe in the future. And when is it? Oh, caller wants me to repeat the website. Well, we'll do that at the very end, but let me just,
College of William and Mary.
Yes. Well, okay. I'd like to leave this in a positive note, and I'd like to say that the weather is a powerful thing, and I think that's what I got out of the experience of driving in it. When I go to the Great Plains, I'm going to my homeland. This is where my father's people became the Dakota people, and I have a lot of family stories about the weather. One of my ancestors, Owl Man, he had a stone, and supposedly that stone could call a storm. He was a powerful medicine man, and when he lived, and so my family still has a stone, and allegedly, if you get it wet, a storm comes. And one time his grandson had it, my great-grandfather, Tipi Sapa, and they were all going in wagons, and this was in the late 19th century, they were fording some place where they would cross the water, he accidentally got it wet. And then he told everyone they had to stake down get in a circle, stake down their wagons, and then wait for the storm to come. And so there is in my family this mythical relationship to the weather of the Great Plains and to the thunder beings, to the Wakion. And when I was driving to the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, and I was, you know, driving through the rain and the water, and I was thinking of that stone that my ancestor had and his relationship to the thunder beings. And as I was driving, and I saw in the sky above the Yankton Sioux Reservation the thunder beings, and the way the weather is on the Great Plains, where you can see it marching across the landscape, it is like a spiritual being, and it is this miraculous thing, and you feel the power of it, and you understand why your ancestors related to it that way. And so, you know, even though I was frightened by what I saw, I was deeply, you know, it's deeply a part of me, you know. And so hopefully the prayers that our people hold and the relationship we have to the land will help in some way, help mediate that power, you know, because it is a great power. And I think that's what I came out of the experience of being subjected to it and awed by it.
Water is life and water is power.
Yes, exactly.
So what was this website? We're just about out of
National
time.
National Congress American News one.
Oh, it's on our program page for Wednesday Talk Radio at KBOO.FM. Do you have it up there?
I'm not sure.
We're just about out of time.
Yeah, I don't think I have it up, but it's on the KBOO website.
Okay, so go to KBOO.FM and look up Wednesday Talk Radio for this date, and you'll find that website, how to help the tribes and communities hit by this bomb cyclone. Well, we're just about out of time. Maybe we'll go out with a little more Buffy St. Marie from her medicine songs, which I encourage everybody to get. This is just a beautiful, beautiful disc. Thank you, Jackie.
Sure.
All right. This is Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio. Coming up, The Radioactivist with Lisa Loving and Suzanne LeGrand.
Turn around and around, little wheel spin and spin, big wheels turn around and around, little wheel spin and spin, big wheels turn around.